Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Urbanite radio stories. In this issue of the Urbanite, this is the December issue. It's out on the stands right now. We are doing having a conversation about the article El Nuevo Baltimore. It's the first time that Urbanite has written an article that is bilingual. It's in Spanish and in English, and it was written by Lucy Hood. And some of the people in that article are joining us in studio now to talk about the Latino communities in Baltimore. We are joined by Nicholas Ramos, who is owner of Arcos Restaurant, and his wife, Tanya Ramos, who is also the owner of Arcos Restaurant. He is from Mexico. She is from Spain. Nicholas is president of the Hispanic Business Association and past president of the Maryland Mexican Association, a member of the governor's Commission on Hispanic Affairs and the Baltimore City Commission on Hispanic Affairs, where he is chairman. We're also joined by Jesse Mejia, and Jesse is the administrator of the Maryland Governor's Commission on Hispanic Affairs. And Nicholas, Tanya, and Jesse, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
So just to jump right into it, I was thinking about before we start this conversation about these words that we use to describe Latino communities, and this word Hispanic that you said, Jesse, was like a totally made-up American word mm-hmm. that never existed before.
Correct. It's made up from the the belief that Española, which is now it's the whole island, but it's the island
of Dominican Republic,
yes, yes. And that was the name that was given to the island by the Spanish, by Christopher Columbus. And so anyone who originates from there, meaning everyone who populated the continent after that island is of, Spanish. And so it's a made-up word that from the Nixon administration. It was to denote people of the Western Hemisphere who are of Spanish descent, who speak Spanish.
And again, when we use, we're talking about when we use the word Latino community, it's really more like Latino communities. Nicholas, you were head of the Mexican Association, the Maryland Mexican Association, but people from El Salvador, from Spain, from Honduras.
Guatemala, all different.
Right.
Yeah, we have more Salvadoreños in the state of Maryland, and they are concentrated in Montgomery County and Prince George. And here in Baltimore is where we have more Mexican. 60% of the Latinos is Mexican.
Oh, really?
In Baltimore. Yes.
Huh.
Yes, we celebrate today the Virgen de Guadalupe. As the Virgin. Most of the Mexicans are Catholic, and we have a big celebration today, December 12th, celebrate the Virgen de Guadalupe and have mariachi and flower and all the Catholic churches.
There's also a large Guatemalan population in the city.
It's Guatemalan, it's Salvadorian, and Honduras. This is the, and then we have some Cuban, Dominican Republican, some Bolivian, and Venezuela, Colombia. And I see, different people all the time, but Baltimore is a welcoming to our community, and it's working very good with the governor. We're highly supported to try to pass the DREAM Act to able to the student, the finish high school, they able to pay the same of the resident in Maryland, and we really need our kids to able to go to college because it's the future of our nation. So we're working hard to try to have passed the DREAM Act, and our governor, Martin O'Malley, really support our community. Same with the local now mayor, Stephanie Rolli, have the Hispanic commissioner where we're working in all different committees like education and health, safe, and housing and economic development. So we really try to work together with our city of Baltimore to able to have more opportunity to our community. They grow almost 150% from the 2000 to 2010.
And some people from Europe.
Yes. Yes, small part, but there are some. Yes.
From Spain. But one of the things let me take a step backwards before I talk about some of the larger issues that when I've had Candelario on the show before, we have kind of talked about that face the Latino communities here in Maryland and in Baltimore. But your own story, you came here, what year?
Yeah, I come in the 1970. I started working in the farm in Texas. And then we went to San Antonio, Texas, my brother and another five Mexican. And we buy a station wagon and the John Jar. And my feeling was in the San Antonio, Texas, we was like not really welcoming to our own Mexican or people, because Texas is a lot of Mexican, but they don't speak no Spanish. So we try to speak Spanish. At this time, we don't speak very good English, and they say, no, hablo español. And this was like, I say, my brother and the other Mexican, let's go buy a car and go to the north, you know. And I think it's more opportunities, and I want to really go into the north of the United States. And we drive a station wagon and $700. We pay $100 each one. We play, we check to make sure room and the transmission work, take to the car wash. And then I buy a little map and see Memphis, Tennessee. And I see, oh, man, Elvis Presley town. So I say, gotta hit over there to Tennessee. And we drop. You know, the highway, I remember like I was 30, 35, we passed Little Rock, and then we crossed the big Mississippi River and went to Tennessee and you know, working and find little jobs and construction. Then we went to Augusta, Georgia, Columbia, South Carolina, and finally here in Laurel, Maryland, we have a great opportunity. Have a lot of work over there in 198 and Route 1. They have a big commercial building and an apartment. And we were working over there very good. And was really in the 1986 when Ronald Reagan was president of the United States and was the Simpson-Rodino amnesty, the less amnesty have in this country. And really was the opportunity when we went to Fairfax, Virginia and applying for permit work.
Right.
And it will become from the shadow to the light and have a social security, then have a checking account. And then we drove to Baltimore and I saw in Broadway a lot of baking houses and big street. And I saw John Hopkins and the top of the hill and I see the waterfront and Fall Point and all the empty houses and very good price and a lot of work. So we start, you know, really working hard in the rehab houses in Baltimore and start by my front house in 70 South Ann Street and start my own company, drywall and painting by Ramos, and going the night to the English classes in the church and then have some classes to read drawings and start my construction company. And I saw after that, in 1990, a lot of more Latinos coming to Baltimore because it was a city of the opportunity. Have a lot of work, have a welcoming, and have a nice people. And we saw, you know, we were, you know, very happy. And I see all the time grow and open a new business from the 1990 all the way to 2006 when it started. The problem with the economy, with the recession, you know, but everything was very good all the way to 2006. 2007 to now is when we had, you know, some...
One of the things the article was talking about, and I think there was a quote that was given to you, Nicholas, was that law that Reagan had passed that allowed people who were here for 5 years to then apply for a green card and to get Social Security taken out, and that changed the lives of a lot of undocumented,
yes,
workers in Mexico and Central America to change their lives and do not everybody ended up buying five houses or whatever number of houses you bought, but it changed the lives of people and one of the things that you were arguing, I think, in the article, mm-hmm. I guess Tanya, you may agree as well, is that if we had a law that opened the door,
well, I think, you know, we need to make sure it's safe and open the door for a people that really we know the a good citizen and a good, you know, they know the neighbor, they know him, and these churches know this a good man, and, you know, make sure our country is safe, because, you know, after the 9/11, we have a big problem, and I agree what changed a lot, and about immigration, and protect the border, and I think, you know, it's good for our community to give opportunity to the good family, to the good father that really care about the kids and working hard, and they here already, and they pay taxes, and they have kids that probably not speak Spanish because they come in here when they was 1 year or probably 2 years old and feel like a discriminate to not able to go to college. And I'm sorry for the interview.
No, this is good. This is good. Tanya, you were about to say something real quick.
No, I just wanted to hear what you were going to say.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, and so there, but there are a lot of issues that face Latino communities in this state. I mean, it's, and there are a lot of, we've talked to people from Casa Candelaria and others about the issues that everyday people face with no protection under the law, really, if you're an undocumented worker being picked up in corners to work in people's places, and those are some really, really very real issues that, mm-hmm. that we don't talk about a great deal.
The law as it is now is pretty vague. What's happening around the country, and you know, a lot of people hear about what's happening in Arizona and what's happening in Alabama. What's happening is local, state. You know, some states are just taking their own action on the immigration issue when it's completely a federal law, and it's a federal, you know, it's under federal law. So what they're doing is they're implementing these draconian, you know, issues to try to solve it. And what's happening is people are abandoning towns. They are abandoning entire cities because they no longer feel like they're safe. I mean, you can get picked up. We hear stories of people, families being broken up because, you know, someone might have done a wrong left turn or a wrong right turn. And you get stopped by the cops, and you know, you may not be asked for papers, but if there is reasonable suspicion, as they call it, you might be taken in, and they may call some of these places. They have, you know, direct communications with Department of Homeland Security, with ICE, and you're no longer hear of people until they're being deported.
I mean, Baltimore City doesn't actually have, they don't have their officers checking those kind of identifications, but they do in Frederick County.
They do. Here in Maryland, we have, you know, as you can see, I mean, even within one state, you can have jurisdictions doing different things. It's not something that's applied across the board. It really is up to whatever, you know, jurisdictions. Some counties do it, some counties don't. In Frederick County, you have people that are being detained and placed in jails until an ICE enforcement official can come and say whether that person is or is not here legally. And, you know, Baltimore City, Montgomery County are still a few of the jurisdictions where they won't apply any type of reasonable suspicion. If you did something wrong, you were ticketed as anybody else would be, and that's it. I mean, there's no the reasonable suspicion part of the law is really what is, you know, breaking up communities, breaking up families.
And also,
Tanya, go ahead.
I'm a mother of four, and my kids were raised in Baltimore City. They grew up in the community, walking the community. My oldest daughter, who's 18, started college this year. She went to school with kids the same as her, that spoke the same English. They studied the same thing, and these kids were not able to continue their education. And it's very sad to see, because I see my daughter progressing in a college.
They couldn't finish. Why?
Because they have no legal papers, so they couldn't go to college. And their parents couldn't afford to pay out-of-state tuition, which made it impossible for them to continue their education. And it was a shame to see that these kids were just as smart and just as intelligent as my own daughter, and with dreams of becoming a nurse or a doctor or a lawyer, and it stopped cold. you know, and now as I'm still in Baltimore and I see a lot of these kids are walking the streets, they can't get jobs, they can't continue their education, and these are kids that could be right now in a school getting an education to better the community, coming back to the community, being a part of it, being a teacher, being a doctor, a lawyer in the community. And unfortunately, they're not able to. And that, you know, that breaks my heart as a mother to see, because these kids grew up with my kids. And I see how they came to a dead end. And it's just very sad.
And this is what the battle is going to be between now and next November in 2012 with the ballot initiative on the DREAM Act, mm-hmm. whether or not these kids will be able to get the same in-state tuition as other children in the state of Maryland. That's going to be a raging battle in the state.
It is. And you have to, looking at it from our perspective, what you have to think about is, you know, there's the issue of achievement gaps in our school system. I mean, we already know of kids that are, you know, having difficulty staying in school. We already know of, you know, just gaps in, you know, education and graduation rates among certain groups. And what's happening is when you have something that, like Tanya said, stops people at a dead end because there's no option after that, that's a huge disincentive for some students. You know, there's no incentive to keep working as hard as you would if you could have the prize at the end, which is to continue your education. I mean, and as far as next year, as the DREAM Act is concerned, you know, the legislature passed it. The governor signed it.
Right.
Now there is this, you know, push to try to get it, you know, get it on the ballot so that all Marylanders can have their voice on it, and that's fine. But I think, you know, we're placing Maryland, or we want to place Maryland in a position where it is competing globally. I mean, the governor just came back from India. You know, he had a delegation of over 100 people that were, you know, there to do business, and it was a very successful event. It was a very successful campaign, and, you know, to have the innovation and to have the, you know, the jobs coming and to have the ability to do that, but then to have some groups in the community not be able to continue higher education. I mean, I think that's just hurting the state. You know, it's suppressing,
Another thing is, I just went through the college process with my daughter, and I realized it's a complicated process. Not everybody that wants to go to college can go to college. Mm-hmm. You have to have the grades. You have to be accepted. You had to work 4 years very hard in order for these schools to look at you. I look at it, if you do that work, you deserve the opportunity to continue your education. You know, people think that because the DREAM Act is here and the kids automatically will go into college. It doesn't work that way. It's only the ones that truly worked hard and truly deserve to go. Mm-hmm. It's not opening the doors to anybody and everybody that wants to go. There is a process and everybody has to follow it. There are kids that work very hard and they should all deserve the right to go to a college.
If I can say something about that, actually, I think at this point the opponents of the act have been more vocal about what they think it is than what it actually is. The DREAM Act, really, what it does is it provides the opportunity for students who have worked really hard for 4 years, who have earned the grades, who have, you know, who really deserve to go to continue their education, to go to school at a rate of like any other student in Maryland. Mm-hmm. That's it. They're not getting anything for free. They're not getting anything reduced other than, you know, having to either pay. Because as it is right now, let's say there was no DREAM Act. Let's say that, you know, everything is as it was. If you're a student who came here through no fault of your own, through your parents brought you here, you grew up in the system, you went through, you know, through all, you know, primary, secondary, and high school, you would be paying three times as much mm-hmm. as you would any other student when you have, you know, the grades. So really, in order, what we're doing here is we're allowing students whose parents pay taxes, they have to prove that they pay taxes, who's who have the grades to be able to go, not even to universities, because as it is, the DREAM Act would allow you to do it. It allows you to go to community colleges.
Right. Right.
Yes, for the first 2 years. And then you can, you know, based on your grades, you can go on to the university. But it's not taking any spots from anyone else. It's not giving anything for free to anyone. It's just allowing students to who have the grades and whose parents pay taxes to go to school.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, and we're speaking with Nicholas Ramos, Tanya Ramos, and Jesse Mejia, one of our Urbanite Radio stories about the growth of a Latino community in Baltimore. And don't go away, because we'll be right back after this very brief break. Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. You're joining us with another one of our Urbanite Radio stories. This one, an article called El Nuevo Baltimore, written by Lucy Hood about the Latino community. And we're speaking with Nicholas Ramos, owner of Arcos Restaurant and president of the Hispanic Business Association here in Baltimore, Tanya Ramos, his wife and co-owner of Arcos Restaurant, and Jesse Mejia, the administrator of the Maryland Governor's Commission on Hispanic Affairs. And here's the rest of our conversation.
I hear many times, you know, a student when they don't even know they are in document and finish with a straight eight in honor classes in high school, and then when they try to apply for a college, they not able to go to a college. So I think, you know, again, you know, the future of our city or state or nation is our kids to able to have education. Because right now the whole world is crazy with all the gangs and problems, the SF and all other countries. So kids where they are 17, 18, 19 years old, they have all this energy where they really want to do something in the right way. And again, I agree with my wife and Jessica, not all the kids really want to do, even American have some kids they do not want to go to college. So why we not try to pick, you know, the best cherries or the trees and give opportunity to keep going these kids, because we need nurses right now. We bring nurses from the other countries because we need here. We need people to work, professional people. And if we have professional in our state, this means wanna be more money, they wanna make it where they wanna pay more taxes, different than 20,000 or 40,000 a year. These kids probably wanna have, you know, over 200,000 or 100,000. So it's better for city, for the state, and for our country. Because compared with China, where the kids is super education over there, they able to have three languages. So it's in 10 years gonna be a big problem is we not do something with this, you know, thousand or million of kids.
One of the statistics I read the other day in an article was that in 30 years. Over half of all the workers in America will be either Latino or African American.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We're going into a majority-minority country. Yeah, we are already actually, some counties are already majority-minority. Montgomery County being one of them. Obviously, the city has been for a long time. So you see it.
And others are inching in that direction.
Very much so, yeah. The last census showed us that there's a lot more brown areas, if I can say that.
So there's one of the things that the article also pointed out was that we say there's 52,000 people who there's Latino communities living in Baltimore, but that's probably not the whole number.
No,
because if you think about the so many people who are undocumented, so many people who are
they
here,
afraid. Yeah,
it's much larger than that.
Yeah, much larger than that. And again, you know, what the time with the police was working with the. With the Germany and all the other countries, now with the Latino town where we really need to work with the diversity of our community to work together for the same thing, you know, for our nation, for our country.
The important thing is to make people feel safe all the way around and have people understand that the police is there to protect them and to help them no matter who they are, where they're from. And that's safety that will help all communities as a whole. You know, when you have people that are scared and that are hiding because they're afraid that they'll be separated from their families, it's when problems start. Because then no one's, you know, everybody's afraid to say. And that's the problem. That's a huge problem.
How much of the work that you do is also bridging between the Latino communities in Baltimore and the African-American communities in Baltimore? Because there's a lot of work jointly together. There's also the chasm that a lot of people, you know, whenever we do a program that's live, the phone calls saying, you know, look, the Latino men are getting all the work and nobody's hiring African American men to do the work, so that tension exists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know,
with our office, with the governor's office, let me tell you, we do a lot of events together, and not just with African American communities. I mean, we are side to side, you know, in our office. The Hispanic Commission is side to side with the Middle Eastern American community. We also have the Native American community. We have the Asian Pacific American community. Our office unit is the Governor's Office of Community Initiatives, and we do a lot of joint programs together. In this coming year, the first thing that we will be working on together, we will have some of our commissioners at the MLK, the birthday celebration. We will be working at St. John's College with some leaders of the African American community, including, I think, the chair of the NAACP here in Maryland. So we have a lot of joint, a lot of mutual projects together. We know that we can't do anything alone, especially in an economy such as the one we are now. I mean, we really have to pull in and, you know, pull in all resources to get anything done. So we know that it's not just us alone. You know, it really has to be a concerted effort to get anything done.
And then that's also changing a lot with the children in school. The generations are growing up together. They're living in the same city. They're going to the same schools. And that blame that you talked about is more towards the older communities. Now that the communities are growing with the children, the friends between the two communities, there's a connection and there's a bond that's growing there. They're neighbors. They walk to school together. So they don't see themselves like that anymore. That's changing too. It's just it takes time. Change takes time. And it has to start by sharing an environment together. And that's what happened in the city of Baltimore. You put two huge communities together and they're living together and working together. And, you know, the older people feel a little bit resentment, but the younger ones that were raised with their neighbors, it's completely different. It changes. And
Nicholas, you want to say something?
Yes, I see, like at my restaurant in Arcos and also Rumba and also in the construction, we working very, very good and hand-to-hand with the African-American. We don't have no problem. We thinking in the same team with the same target, with the same vision, and you know, I have a very good friend, African American, and also Chinese, and the other. I started the multicultural organization where we had people from Nepal, people from Korea, Vietnam, And I told you, you know, we had, I had personal more friend African American than like a good friend, like even, you know, and other people. We in my restaurant all the time, you know, talking about what we wanna do, like a business plan. We create a different network, and I have in my Facebook a lot of friend, you know, working with the mayor, working with all the commissioner, and I think, you know, we start working very good, but we need more. We need more Latinos working, I think, in the city, and good people in the different other areas in the state. We need too much work to do our community. We really need have more like a bilingual people and more police and more like 911 in Spanish, because they need it.
And the other side, this is they're dealing with kind of serious issues. The other part is that this is also serious but different, is that there's been in the last, I don't know, what has it been, 10, 15 years, since more and more Latinos have been coming in from Mexico and Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador, the nature of the city has changed. In the feel of the city, especially on the east side of town, with mm-hmm. restaurants and clubs, and it's a new world is opening up. Greek town is now could be Latino town.
Yeah, you see every month, you know, but right now I think everybody have a little problem. I hope it start changing in the 2012, but I don't see a big change, but we really working hard, and we try to work in together with all the other community, working hand by hand, and the baking house to value, and working hand by hand with the police, and working hand by hand with the health, with the problem the everybody have. But it's our community have a culture, have a food, have a music, and now you can see in Baltimore, you know, when you're driving for Broadway and Easter Avenue, Highland Town, so you see all the Latinos now in the store, like they talking in the Urbanite and like Santoni's and the other couple big supermarkets. You see the Latino area where you find jalapeno pepper and jicama.
Yes, and all this. When we moved here from New Jersey in the 80s, and my father had to have his paper shipped over from New Jersey because he couldn't find a Spanish newspaper in Baltimore. And I remember, you know, sitting there, and he goes, "It's 3 days late, all this passed already." You know, but there was nowhere to get. There was one small Latino market, and even our church, we had Spanish Mass once a month, the first Sunday every month. And I remember how it changed through the years. It went from one Sunday to every other Sunday to every Sunday to now we have it not only on Sundays, but we have it on Saturdays as well.
Yes.
And the church is filled with people.
Yeah.
You know, so you see the changes, and you see the changes of the buildings. You see the brighter colors, and you see the stores. I think it's beautiful. I think it just creates an amazing part of Baltimore. It just enhances what Baltimore has, made it better.
Well, I think to me, I think it's an exciting and is just, and I like it as well. I think it's just the character of the city has expanded. People, it's a change sometimes has these negative connotations. Oh, it's changing. What's changing? Look out! But mm-hmm. No, I mean it's expanding, and it's becoming.
Yes.
It's a vibrancy to it that I think is important.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we say in my house that we serve our crabs with a side order of guacamole.
I've never tried that with my crabs.
But you know, that makes it better. It just enhances what you have.
So I'm curious what where you think that, you know, when you look at what's happening now and with the economy being down, that so many people are not finding work, and especially in the Black community and in especially Central American Latino communities, that, you know, it's getting harder and harder because most people don't own restaurants. They work. Well, it's getting harder. It's construction or wherever else they work.
Well, it's getting harder and harder for those that own businesses as well. And this is what the times are. But what we're seeing is we're also seeing people coming together to help each other out and support each other, something that I think needed to be done. You know, people know what everybody's going through. They know that their neighbor is going through the same thing, and they extend their hand. And, you know, the same thing with the government. I mean, especially here in Maryland, there's so many ways to get help, mm-hmm. and there's always someone out there willing to give you a hand when you're in a bad situation.
Right. And if I can say a little bit
Please,
more about that, you know, the government really has, I think, prioritized what is the social safety net, you know, safety net more so now than before. We have we have concentrated our efforts in making sure that people know about the resources that exist in order to help families. One thing that we did last year that had not been done before was foreclosure mitigation resources. You know, the governor put together over what now is over 1,000 pro bono lawyers to help families across Maryland. And one of the things that we have done with the commission, with the Governor's Commission on Hispanic Affairs has done, is we've partnered with the Department of Housing and Community Development to bring the resources to bilingually, to bring it to communities everywhere. So we have been working. What we have done is we kind of see ourselves as the middle person, you know, the middle entity that helps the agencies reach out to not just everyone, but it's everyone in as many languages as possible. I know that they probably have been working with some of the other commissions as well, but we have made sure that, you know, with Nicolas and with some of the other commissioners, that we are right at the front of, you know, some of these efforts to help people. So, again, not just DHD, you know, DHDC is the Department of Housing and Community Development, but, you know, with Minority Affairs, where we have business economic development help for small businesses. So we have, you know, our agencies that we are working very, very closely with to make sure that we are helping all families.
It's been really a pleasure to have this. I'm Mark Steiner. We've been listening to this, another one of our wonderful Urbanite radio stories. This is a story in this month's Urbanite that we've been talking about three guests, El Nuevo Baltimore, the first article in the Baltimore Magazine's history that has been bilingual.
There you go.
Side by side, Spanish and English, the whole article. Jesse Mejia, who's with us, is the administrator for the Maryland Governor's Office Commission on Hispanic Affairs. Nicholas Ramos and Tanya Ramos, who own Arcos Restaurant. And, of course, Nicholas Ramos is an important civic leader in this town in many associations in the Latino community and across the city. Well, thank you all so much for being here on the Steiner Show today. It's good to have you.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to the Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.